You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, the gunner is nowhere to be found right now. So what we're going to do is you're going to get a chance to listen to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from yesterday. So you'll hear a little bit of a preamble, and then and like I said, it's awesome. If you want to be, again, Grant Newsham makes you smart about Korea. Listen to General Joe Dunford, and he'll make you smart about the future of Afghanistan, what we're trying to do in Syria on a much broader scale, and Turkey as well.
Mr. Chairman, the floor is yours.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, thanks. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much. It is good to join you here today, and I appreciate the flexibility of the club in rescheduling. I canceled at the last minute in April, which I typically don't have to do, but as you can understand, sometimes that's required and had to do that. I'm actually glad that it was a relatively slow news weekend, so I come in on a Monday. There's probably not many questions and not much you're interested in, and there's certainly nothing controversial that I could address today. So, I feel very comfortable. So, with that, Jeff, I'll turn it over to you.
We'll just go right into the questions. We thought we were going to have a few extra minutes, but fine.
I'm happy to do that. I didn't think you were looking for a filibuster.
No, not at all. Clearly, we had, just to jump right into it, we just had a very tense shoot down of a Syrian jet by U.S. forces. And we had a very ominous statement from Russia that plays into the whole deconfliction agreement between the countries, essentially saying anything west of the Euphrates, we're shooting down. What's your reaction to that? Are there any developments? Do you have any updates on where that stands? Is deconfliction gone? I mean, what's the latest there?
First of all, we've worked very hard on deconfliction, and it's important to point out why. For the last 8 months, we worked on deconfliction with the Russian Federation and pro-regime forces through the Russians. The purpose was to make sure that our air crews were safe, to make sure our personnel on the ground were safe, and to make sure we could prosecute the defeat ISIS campaign in Syria, which is the reason why we're in Syria. That has worked very well over the past 8 months, and we have worked through a number of issues with the Russian Federation. We have an effective link between our air operations center in Qatar and the Russian Federation on the ground in Syria. That link is still ongoing here this morning. When I left the building this morning, we're still been communicating over the last few hours. I, like you, saw in the open source some reporting from Moscow, which I won't address right now. I would just tell you that we'll work diplomatically and militarily in the coming hours to reestablish deconfliction. The Russian Federation has indicated that their purpose in Syria, like ours, is to defeat ISIS, and we'll see if that's true here in the coming hours, because all of our operations in and around Raqqa and southern Syria are designed specifically to get after ISIS, and we have agreed in the past, that is, we in the Russian Federation and pro-regime forces, that operations that the coalition was conducting in Syria were effectively degrading ISIS's capability, and we'll work to restore that deconfliction chain in the next few hours.
So are you confident that U.S. forces won't be shot down?
I'm confident that we are still communicating between our operations center and the Russian Federation operations center, and I'm also confident that our forces have the capability to take care of themselves.
Okay, because some people have been writing in some of those early questions. I mean, did Russia effectively declare World War III? I mean, it's not that bad, but
yeah. Honestly, Jeff, I think the worst thing any of us could do right now would be, address this thing with hyperbole. An incident occurred. We have to work through the incident. We have a channel to be able to do that, and I think it's going to require some diplomatic and military engagement in the next few hours to restore the deconfliction that we've had in place. And again, the deconfliction that we've had in place is in our mutual interest, because it allows us to address what at least pro-regime forces have indicated is our common enemy, ISIS.
And have you been in touch with your counterpart in Russia?
I have not, as of yet. This morning. Mm-hmm. I have met with my Russian counterpart twice this year, and we've communicated maybe another five or six times.
Which also leads to, what's the situation in Raqqa going to be when it's all said and done? Who's going to control it? You've got a number of questions about how that recasts the situation
sure.
in the region.
First of all, we're supporting the Syrian Democratic Forces in seizing Raqqa. That's a force of about 50,000, of which about 20,000 to 25,000 are Arab, and the balance are Kurdish. Even as we support their efforts to seize Raqqa, there's an ongoing effort led by the State Department to put together a governance body so that as soon as Raqqa is seized, there is effective local governance. That governance will leverage Arab leaders who are from Raqqa, and will also work on establishing a security force made up of local personnel so that there is stabilization efforts that will follow the seizure of Raqqa.
Let's move around the region a bit. Iraqi Kurds have announced that they are going to hold an independence referendum on September 25th. What would that mean for U.S. interest in the Middle East? Should the U.S. support it?
Look, our stated objective at this point is a stable, secure, and sovereign Iraq, and we're supporting Iraqi security forces in defeating ISIS inside of Iraq. And I think the issue of the Kurdish referendum is one that will have to be worked out between President Barzani and Prime Minister Abadi and the Iraqi people.
Just going back to the question also becomes in the earlier things about Russia and Syria and whatnot, that whether or not you have to relocate or strengthen the security even more at the TANF training base to be prepared for other regime attacks. They keep saying it's defensive strikes only against the regime, but when does this cross the line into war with the Syria government?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that the incident that took place this weekend followed a combined arms movement of pro-regime forces. Subsequent aircraft flew into the area. We made every effort to warn those individuals not to come any closer. And then the commander made a judgment that there was a threat to the forces that we were supporting and took action. The only actions that we have taken against pro-regime forces in Syria, and there have been two specific incidents, have been in self-defense, and we've communicated that clearly.
Back to Afghanistan. Do you foresee adding the 4,000 troops? There's a lot of discussion about whether or not there have been additional forces allocated to Afghanistan. Has that decision been made? How many troops are going? When are they going? And how is that going to unfold?
Sure. Let me see if I can probably answer that question and a few others that haven't been asked about Afghanistan right up front. First of all, no decision has been made with regard to the deployment of additional forces in Afghanistan. One decision that was made by the president was to delegate that decision to Secretary Mattis in terms of forces that would be on the ground. But also, and this is what's important and probably has been underreported, is that Secretary Mattis's decision about additional forces in Afghanistan will be made in the context of a broader strategy review for South Asia that is ongoing and is expected to report back probably sometime in the middle of July. So when Secretary Mattis makes a decision about force levels, which he will clearly communicate with the President, the Secretary of State, in fact, the guidance, the direction that he's received is to do that in conjunction with the Secretary of State. When Secretary Mattis makes that decision about force levels, you know, you can expect that he'll communicate that in a broader context, again, specifically the context of that strategy review. So, you know, it won't be just about Afghanistan. There are a number of interdependent variables that bear on the problem inside of Afghanistan across the region, and we'll be prepared to talk about those as well when we talk about force management levels. The reason why this number 4,000 has been raised is there is a request by the commander to thicken the advise-assist effort in Afghanistan. In other words, he's identified areas where he believes additional forces could make the advisor effort in Afghanistan more effective. There is also an outstanding requirement for forces that the commander asked for from NATO last year, and so that's what you've also heard him talk about publicly. And we're short about 3,000 from the stated NATO requirement for forces in Afghanistan. So that's where the numbers come from. But again, what I'd emphasize is that any decision on numbers is going to be done in that broader context.
And speaking of strategy, Senator McCain came up swinging this morning. You have to give him credit. He's going to both Democratic and Republican presidents and Congress and controlled Congresses about whether or not there's a strategy for Afghanistan. And he's asking, where is it? When's it going to be delivered? What's going to, you know, where is it going to be? Where is it headed? What's your take on that?
Sure. Well, Secretary Mattis and I had the opportunity to appear before Chairman McCain and the Senate Armed Services Committee last Tuesday. And when he raised that question, Secretary Mattis said that, number one, we agree that Afghanistan is not where we want it to be. And we have spent the last couple months discussing where it might go in the future. And he, as I will today, indicated to Chairman McCain that sometime in the middle of July would have that strategic review complete. We certainly will consult with Chairman McCain and the other members of the Congress as the coming weeks go on. And then when the Secretary makes a decision about resourcing for the military dimension, realizing that there's broader issues that have to be addressed in the diplomatic and economic areas.
Which raises the question of the authorization of use of military force again. How much lobbying, if you will, is happening between you and the Congress, or just are you? How's the dialogue unfolding in terms of eventual, actual passage of an authorization for the use of military force, and how is that going to be applied?
Yeah, Jeff. I mean, I haven't lobbied, but I've been asked several times. In testimony, what my thoughts were on the authorization of use of military force. And for those who don't know, we're relying now on the 2001 authorization of use of military force that was after 9/11. It was modified in 2002. What I have said is that we have all of the legal authority that we need right now to prosecute Al-Qaeda, ISIS, other affiliated groups. But my recommendation to the Congress was that they pass an authorization of use of military force, and I thought one of the more important things is that our men and women that are in harm's way would see a clear and unmistakable support from the American people through their Congress. That's what I believe right now would be very positive if Congress would pass an authorization of use of military force. And again, I haven't lobbied for that effort. I'm precluded in law from lobbying. But when I'm asked in testimony, as I have been now several times, I'm certainly able to answer that question. And what I have focused on is the message that would be sending to those people who are actually making a sacrifice, that what message would be sent if Congress would authorize use of military force.
So what do you
it would reinforce, yeah. I think, the message.
So what, speaking of, what do you say to an American voter who's deciding whether or not they're going to voice an opinion to their member of Congress about who might be skeptical that thousands of more U.S. troops could be deployed and a slightly tweaked strategy might break the stalemate in Afghanistan or other parts of the region, and after billions of dollars that have been spent and everything that's been done, is there sort of a fatigue that's out there? How are you going to convince the American people that this is going to be a necessary thing if you decide to deploy thousands of troops to the region for Afghanistan and if you have to escalate your involvement in Syria?
Yeah, I think it's important that the conversation about Afghanistan take place in the context of our vital national interests in South Asia and South Asia as a whole. And there are two, very simply, that I would talk about in public. One is the remaining threat from terrorist organizations in South Asia who have expressed the desire to have another 9/11 in the United States and conduct attacks. There's about 17 different groups of the 20 that we've globally identified as terrorist organizations. 17 of them operate in the South Asia area. And continuing to put pressure on those groups, I believe, is critical and vital to our national interests. And I would also argue that the pressure that those groups have been under for the last 15 years has been what has prevented another 9/11. The other interest that we have in the region is preventing a regional conflict in South Asia. So, again, when the strategy comes in, it's less about what's happened over the past 16 years than it is about what are our national interests today in South Asia, what is the context within which we are pursuing our national interests in South Asia, and what's the diplomatic, economic, and military campaign plan that's necessary for us to protect and advance our national interests in South Asia. I don't believe it's useful to have a conversation about where we've been, how much money we've spent, or how long we have been in Afghanistan. What's most important is articulating to the American people their interest in that region. Why does it matter here in the United States? We owe them that. We should be able to articulate that when we roll out the strategy. And what is it that we're doing, again, not just militarily, but diplomatically and economically to advance our interests? And that's the conversation we'll be prepared to have.
So what's the end game in Afghanistan, in Syria, and what's your prediction for new cost in U.S. lives if that were to happen?
Yeah, what I would say is, from a military dimension, you know, to be clear about what is it we're trying to do, we're trying to support our partners on the ground in driving the level of violence down to where local security forces can actually deal with security challenges with a minimal amount of international support. And we're trying to do that from West Africa to Southeast Asia, because what we're dealing with is a trans-regional threat. One of the manifestations of that trans-regional threat is in Afghanistan, but again, it extends from West Africa to Southeast Asia. And in all cases, that's the broad design of our strategy, is to support local forces in actually addressing those security challenges. Some need more support than others, but the methodology is consistent across that trans-regional threat.
To what degree does that involve pressuring Pakistan?
Well, I think Pakistan is a key to Afghanistan and its security, and in ensuring that Haqqani does not have sanctuary in South Asia, making sure the Taliban don't have sanctuary in South Asia, making sure there's a secure border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is critical, making sure there's effective political and military relationships between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's one of the interdependent variables that's going to allow us to be successful.
Going back to Syria. Can you talk about the role that Iran is playing in Syria? Is it increasing?
If you're just tuning in, this is General Joe Dunford, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, yesterday at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. You can see there's a reason why he's got his job, okay? And again, what's missing, you know, obviously in the national news is you don't get this narrative unless you tune into something like this and you get a chance to listen to him in long format. When he begins to link these issues, talk about the whys to them, talk about the keys to them, where they're going to, this is the narrative that the American people need to hear. So, because you're smart, you listen to All Marine Radio and you get to hear it. But, yeah, Dunford, I mean, incredible, incredible human being. So let me rewind it by about 30 seconds and pick it back up.
South Asia, making sure there's a secure border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is critical, making sure there's effective political and military relationships between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's one of the interdependent variables that's going to allow us to be successful.
Going back to Syria, can you talk about the role that Iran is playing in Syria? Is it increasing, particularly through Hezbollah?
Yeah, I mean, Iran is playing an unhelpful role in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East. Some of you may have heard me describe it this way before. I think their major export is malign influence across the Middle East. And so, you know, again, Iran, unlike the United States and the coalition, is not focused on ISIS inside of Syria. Iran is focused on propping up the regime that committed atrocities in the civil war. And from my perspective, addressing the grievances of the civil war in Syria is going to be necessary for us to have peace and stability and no longer have a sanctuary for violent extremism.
Staying in the region, are you concerned about any long-term implications of the current Gulf crisis on regional security? And has the crisis affected U.S. military operations in the region? I think you said something last week on Capitol Hill that your operations are relatively unaffected, but with Turkey sending troops in and the Army, the U.S. Army, bringing troops around in around Qatar, what's happening in terms of operations with CENTCOM right there in the middle of the country that's at the center?
Sure. I mean, and I think most people know, but the reason why we watch Qatar, among the many reasons we watch Qatar so closely, is that's where our Combined Air Operations Center is located. That's where the preponderance of aircraft that support our current campaign against ISIS is located. And so it's pretty significant. That's also the location of the forward command post for the United States Central Command. What I would tell you is, you know, has there been friction associated with what's ongoing, the political challenges between the GCC and Qatar? Absolutely. But what I said last week remains true, in that we have continued to be able to operate even through that friction.
And what are you playing any sort of diplomatic role in trying to resolve the issues working in concert with Secretary Tillerson and so forth?
Yeah, we obviously work the military-to-military lane, and we're continuing to do that in support of Secretary Tillerson. But I think, Jeff, you answered the question well. This is primarily Secretary Tillerson's lane right now to resolve this issue between the GCC and Qatar and come up with a negotiated solution to the challenge that addresses the issue.
With Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and their offshoots popping up all over the world with a World War II-style strategy of defeating this enemy with our allies in various parts of the world? I can't quite read this.
Okay, I'll speculate as to what that individual means. First of all, we don't have – it's probably important. Let me explain our strategy for dealing with trans-regional violent extremism, again, of which ISIS is one manifestation. First of all, what connects the groups from West Africa to Southeast Asia? Really three things: the flow of foreign fighters, the flow of resources, and the narrative, the message that they disseminate. So strategically, the idea is to be able to cut, and I describe those three things as connective tissue between the groups. So strategically, what we're trying to do is cut that connective tissue. How are we doing that? By establishing a broad coalition with a good exchange of information and intelligence so that we can get after the flow of money, the flow of foreign fighters, and deal with the narrative. We have now 60 members in a coalition just in Iraq and Syria. I met a few months ago with about 45 of my counterparts from around the world to improve our information and intelligence sharing. We have an interagency intelligence and information sharing location in the Middle East, where right now we have about 20 countries that are represented both militarily and their intelligence organizations and their interagency. When I say interagency in the United States, it would be organizations like Homeland Security. And the idea is like-minded nations sharing the intelligence information that will allow not just for effective military operations, which is one dimension of the problem, but also an effective legal framework in countries where foreign fighters either came from or will return to, and also an effective way of sharing information so we can anticipate the flow of foreign fighters and resources. So with regard to the combat operations, those combat operations then are designed to enable local forces to deal with specific regional challenges. So there's a number of regional efforts, but there's a strategic framework that connects those regional efforts, and that strategic framework is getting after those three elements that actually connect these organizations. In the long-term end state of the strategy is drive the level of violence down in each of the countries where it exists, in each of the regions where it exists, drive the level of violence down, and increase the capacity of local forces such that local forces can deal with that challenge. That's where we're going. That's very much unlike a World War II strategy. And in very isolated cases, our U.S. or coalition forces do in the fighting. The majority of fighting, and you can look at the majority of casualties, are being experienced by local forces that are fighting for their own countries. And that's the strategy. So I'd be happy to have a reattack if somebody wants to come back and ask another question about that strategy, because I think understanding that is very important. And by the way, my assessment, my assumption probably more properly, is that we're going to be dealing with violent extremism for a long period of time. Some people have described it as a generational problem. Whatever it is, it's going to be a long period of time. And so one critical element of our strategy is that it must be politically sustainable, it must be fiscally sustainable, and it must be militarily sustainable. And the one thing I want the American people to know is that we're conducting a campaign against violent extremism in the context of all of the challenges that face our country right now, to include North Korea, China, Iran, and Russia. And so when I talk about sustainability, it's sustainability in the context of making sure that we can address – the United States is a nation that thinks and acts globally. We don't have the luxury of dealing with one thing at a time. We're dealing with all of those simultaneously. And to deal with all of those simultaneously, again, you need to have a strategy that's sustainable. And in the case of violent extremism, fully leverages the capabilities of local partners on the ground who, again, are doing most of the fighting and most of the sacrifice is from local forces.
Now, speaking of the list you just spouted, North Korea. What is North Korea has been increasingly active, shall we say, in its missile tests. How are the U.S. forces positioning themselves to deal with this particular threat, if you're seeing it as a threat? And how are you trying to de-escalate what is an increasing tension in the region? And specifically, how is the new South Korean president helping in this regard?
Sure. First of all, to the question, do I view it as a threat? I do. It's clear to me that Kim Jong-un, the regime, is on a path of attempting to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile and matching that with a nuclear warhead that can reach the United States. We should be concerned about that, and we are. The primary means of dealing with that is diplomatic and economic pressure, a campaign led by Secretary Tillerson. The military dimension on a day-to-day basis is in support of Secretary Tillerson. As a result, we have a very open dialogue, a very aggressive dialogue with the State Department to make sure that everything that we're doing in terms of our military posture is supportive of Secretary Tillerson's primarily economic and diplomatic campaign. And many of you have watched closely what's happened in the UN. There's been two, I think, unprecedented sanctions regimes that have been passed this year, and that's the primary way that Secretary Tillerson hopes to do that. In the meantime, we have a responsibility, we, the Department of Defense, number one, to deter any provocation by Kim Jong-un in the meantime, and to provide the president with a list of options in the event that hostilities occur. And that's exactly what we're doing. So, again, what I would emphasize is the military dimension today is in support of the diplomatic and economic effort led by the State Department. And at the same time, we have an effective posture in the region to deter KJU and also to respond in the event that deterrence fails.
Speaking of North Korea and China, it seems that the president has been trying to utilize a newfound relationship with his counterpart in China to try to resolve tensions in North Korea. How is that impacting what you just said? And is there anything that you're doing in the region that might have an adverse effect? For example, what you're doing with the South China Seas.
Right. So the president met with the president of China at Mar-a-Lago, I think it was the end of April. They discussed two issues. One of them was this issue of North Korea and the commitment to denuclearize the peninsula. Secretary Tillerson has said that a key element of any success we would have in denuclearizing the peninsula would be the cooperation of China. So it's a bit early probably to judge how far we've come in the past 4 or 5 weeks, but that's a critical piece. In the meantime, Jeff, to talk about other things that we are doing that might be kind of productive to gaining China's support up in North Korea, we view that issue as separate from other issues in the region that we're dealing with, and we maintain open lines of communication with our Chinese counterparts. And to that point, we will this week have a meeting at the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense level with their counterparts. I'll join that and then follow up with a day with my counterpart in the Pentagon. We will discuss a wide range of issues to include the issue that we just spoke about at length, the North Korea issue.
Sorry to jump back to Syria. Our good colleague John Donnelly from CQ Roll Call. What's the legal justification for targeting Syria government forces?
Yeah, we are there and have legal justification under the authorization to use of military force. We are prosecuting a campaign against ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Cyber attacks. Cyber attacks threaten the national infrastructure and our complex weapons and defense systems. How is the military doing in recruiting the talent needed to defend and defeat cyber attacks?
Yeah, whoever asked that question, I think it's a great question and something I don't take for granted. One thing I would have said if I did filibuster up front and talked about our people, I would tell you that we have effectively recruited and retained an all-volunteer force even after 16 years at war. But there are certain skill sets, and cyber is one of them, where we have a growth industry inside the department, and there's a lot of competition in the industry for the same people that we're trying to incentivize to join the U.S. military or serve as a civilian. So we're not taking that for granted. We are, as you know, looking across the department for different ways to modernize our personnel system to do just that, to recruit and retain high-quality people, to include cyber. We have grown the cyber force. We had a plan for 133 cyber mission teams. We outlined that plan about 3 years ago. 70% of those teams now have reached full operational capability. All the rest are reached initial operational capability. That means they're out there doing what they get paid to do every day. So we have met the current requirement, but as we look forward, I imagine that our requirements will grow. We've identified a requirement to grow our cyber capability. That means we'll need more high-quality, motivated people to come in that are committed to the mission, and we've got to find a way to incentivize that. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the way we've done business in the past is the way we're going to be able to do business in the future.
And another one from the audience. How do you create a rational military strategy with an impulsive president?
Okay, I don't think someone really expects me to answer a question like that. and I mean that sincerely. I mean, the one thing that I'm very proud of, and I hope as Americans, I mean, I am proud of freedom of the press, and I'm proud of what you do every day, and I'm not just saying that. But I also...
Thank you, sir.
No, I mean that. And I've said that in private to the folks I work with closely in the Pentagon. But I hope you're equally proud that the United States military remained apolitical during a very difficult political season. And I'm certainly proud of our men and women in uniform, and I can't think of a single case where an active duty member has violated what in effect is our ethos. And I'm equally sensitive to making sure that that record maintains in the future. And as the senior U.S. military officer in the country, I think, you know, our men and women look to me as an example, and so I would never answer a question like that. And so thanks.
Just a reminder to those who may be watching, not everybody in the room is a journalist, so we ask for a bit of a decorum from our colleagues, and hold your applause. Those who are applauding may be guests or members of the public. The United States is providing thousands of weapons and heavy weapons to Kurdish groups, which have been regarded as terrorist organizations by Turkey. How do you guarantee that these weapons will not be turned against your 65-year-old NATO ally after fighting against ISIL?
We are very focused on maintaining the relationship that we have, as you pointed out, Jeff, our NATO ally in Turkey. And to that point, I've made 9 trips to Turkey in the past 12 months. I've met with my Turkish counterpart probably no less than 15 times in the last year to try to make sure we maintain a very effective relationship with a NATO ally. We've also told them that at the end of the day, a key element of our campaign is making sure we accomplish the mission with our relationship with Turkey, our NATO ally, intact. So we have sat down with the Turks. We have a very tight framework to allay their concerns. We have transparency in reporting. We're providing them routine reports of exactly what we're doing. We're providing them transparency on the type of weapons that we have, and we have put in mechanisms in place to make sure that the weapons that we're providing to the Syrian Democratic Forces are intended for Raqqa and Raqqa only and don't find their way back inside of Turkey. So whoever asked that question, it's a very important question. It's a strategic question because it affects a relationship with an important ally. But we're mindful of that. And to that point, Secretary Mattis next week will once again meet with his Turkish counterpart in Europe and go through this. And last Thursday, he wrote a very detailed letter to his Turkish counterpart providing a routine update. And again, both I speak routinely to General Hulusi Akar, who's become a good friend. He's the Turkish Chief of Defense. And General Mike Scaparotti, our European Command commander, speaks to General Akar probably at least once a week. And we have a very, very robust presence of both the United States Central Command and the United States European Command in Ankara in a joint operations center with our Turkish counterparts, again, to mitigate the concerns that you outlined, Jeff.
Thank you. Jumping around a bit, Senate passed a broad sanctions package last week against Iran and Russia. How are the details of that, broad strokes, impacting U.S. military strategy in those countries? In the region, both towards Russia and towards Iran.
Yeah, sorry for a relatively short answer on that, but there's been no impact on the military dimension of our relationship with either country at this point.
Okay. Budget questions, and there's a lot of them. Are you comfortable
after 17 hours of testimony?
I was going to say, you were on the Hill quite a bit.
I'm really looking forward to these. Go ahead, Jeff.
Are you comfortable with how the U.S. is defending defense dollars to address emerging military capabilities of near competitor states?
Yeah, the short answer is no, and let me walk back. I think it's fair to say at the turn of the century, 2000, we had a decisive competitive advantage in our ability to project power when and where necessary to advance our interests and meet our alliance commitments. We could do that. And just for those who don't track what we do routinely, I believe there are two sources of strength in our country, at the strategic level It's the network of allies and partners that we have built up since World War II. And at the operational level, it's been our historic ability to project power from the United States, again, to advance our interests and meet our alliance commitments. Our peer competitors have studied the United States since Desert Storm. They studied the development of precision munitions. They studied our ability to project power. And in almost every case, you look at China, Russia, Iran in particular, what they have done over the last few years is started to develop what has been called in the trade journals the anti-access area denial capability. And what that simply means is develop a wide range of capabilities that keep the United States from moving into Europe, in the case of Russia, moving into the Pacific, meeting our alliance commitments, or then operating freely within Europe or within the Pacific. And so my greatest concern, and the emphasis that I placed on it last week in testimony, I think highlights that, is that the United States of America has to maintain a competitive advantage in the ability to project power when and where necessary to meet our alliance commitments or advance our interests. And as a result of anti-ship cruise missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles, electronic warfare capability, anti-space capability, a wide other range of maritime offensive undersea capabilities, you know, there are areas of concern. And so one of the things that we're doing at a very classified level is communicating with Congress to talk about the areas of competitive advantage, and we've identified a number of those. And we can talk with specificity about where are we today relative to where we need to be in maintaining a competitive advantage, where will we be in 5 years in our ability to maintain a competitive advantage, and what specific capabilities must be fielded to ensure that the chairman in 2022 or 2023 could be as confident of our ability to project power then as I am today. So, again, as a result of unstable budgets and operational tempo, while we have been focused on violent extremism, while we have delayed modernization programs from the nuclear enterprise to our shipbuilding program, our potential adversaries haven't had to suffer through that same experience, and what they have been on is a very consistent pattern of capability development designed specifically, again, to limit our ability to project power. And as Americans, we should be concerned about that because our ability to project power is a critical element of conventional deterrence. And I believe right now that our competitive advantage conventionally has, in fact, mitigated the risk of conflict. And a loss of that competitive advantage conventionally would be a risk. And obviously, the loss of a safe, effective, and reliable nuclear deterrent is also a concern. And so that really is the primary thrust of our budget recommendations.
Well, between the Budget Control Act, the continuing resolutions, your countless hours of testimony, has Congress and the White House essentially, you know, failed the military by not coming to an agreement and getting the military the stability it needs and its funding to increase its personnel, strengthen its modernization, and all those other things you just mapped out? As I was reading through your scores of hours of testimony, and House, Senate, committee by committee by committee, the same things kept coming up over and over and over again, that you were being effectively shortchanged.
Yeah, the one thing that I said in testimony and I routinely say is I fundamentally don't believe we should be sending our young men and women into a fair fight. We shouldn't be doing that as Americans. We're going to send them someplace. We ought to send them with the wherewithal to accomplish the mission with a minimal loss of life or equipment. That's, I think, a responsibility. We're not going to be able to do that with the Budget Control Act. We're not going to be able to do that with more continuing resolutions. We are where we are right now. It began back in 2012, and with the exception of one assignment, I've been intimately involved in where we've been since 2012 with regard to the budget. And as a result of continuing resolutions every year, as a result of the Budget Control Act, we haven't been able to properly prioritize and allocate the resources the American people give to us for the nation's defense. And if we don't lift the budget caps, if we don't repeal the Budget Control Act, and we don't get back to regular order, that is, passing a budget every year, we will not get out of the trough that we have found ourselves in as a result of 7 or 8 or 9 years. And it's going to take us some time to get out of that trough. But the only way we'll get out of that trough is to have regular order in a budget process. We cannot sustain the path we're on right now and maintain that competitive advantage.
Speaking of regular order, you There are several things you can pluck out of that. I mean, you've got decades-old ICBMs. You've got all this, you know, military vehicles that are not equivalent to their peer counterparts in competitor nations. Where do you start? I mean, there seems to be a long, long laundry list of what you have to fix in order to be competitive.
Yeah, first of all, it starts with the nuclear enterprise, and we've made that we believe that's the department's number one responsibility is to deter nuclear war. And it would be nice if we didn't have to invest in a nuclear enterprise. It would be nice if nuclear weapons weren't a part of our national defense strategy. But the truth of the matter is the enemy gets a vote, and actually Russia has increased the role of nuclear weapons in their defense strategy, and maintaining an effective deterrence is important. So that's job one. I spoke about our ability to project power, Jeff, and again, what we have done is we've taken a look at each of the four state actors and the one non-state actor. So I don't use this 4+1, as what we call it inside the building, as a predictive model, but here's an important assumption that you can test. What I believe is if we build a U.S. military with the right inventory of capabilities and the right capacities, that is the right size, so the right capabilities and the right size force that can deal with Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, or violent extremism, or some combination thereof, that will have the right force in the future to maintain a competitive advantage and deal with what we most certainly will deal with is the unexpected. I mean, as I tell people, if there's anything I've learned in 40 years of active duty, it's to be humble about our ability to predict the future. But again, just like any industry, you have to benchmark yourself against something. So what we have done is benchmarked ourselves against those 4+1. And the way we will inform our priorities that we provide to Congress is by looking at where we are today relative to where we'll be 5 years from now in terms of our competitive advantage. And that will be where the priorities outside the nuclear enterprise are established. And, of course, there's other things about training the force and so forth, but I'm speaking about it from a joint inventory perspective.
Let's go global again. You mentioned briefly NATO. When the president was on his overseas trip, he had some pretty tough words for NATO. How did those words have an effect on your dealings with your counterparts and with the allies that we have dealt with for so long?
This is, and some may find this hard to believe, but first of all, I was in NATO, I think, probably 10 days ago. I'm there at least every quarter, met with all now 29 members of NATO. Witness this afternoon, I think about 4 o'clock, I'll meet with my Montenegrin counterparts. So I'm either speaking to or meeting with one of my NATO counterparts every week. That certainly a week doesn't go by where I'm not meeting with one or more of them. So I have a pretty good sense, I think, for where we are in our relationship. And I would tell you, the military-to-military relationship, to include our combined operations in Afghanistan, to include our combined operations in Syria and Iraq, to include the partnership we have with the French in West Africa, to include the partnership we have with the French in the United Kingdom and the United States in East Africa, has not suffered a bit. And frankly, I think given the common challenges we have right now, I'd find someone hard-pressed historically to go back and find a time when more than 30 nations have stayed together in the fight for over a decade like we have in Afghanistan, or we've been able to put together a coalition of 60 countries, of which 22 are actually contributing effective military capabilities in Iraq and Syria. So what I would ask you to do when you think about what impact or where we are with regard to our allies is look at what we're doing, not what we're saying. And what we're doing across the world is, I believe, from a coalition and alliance perspective, pretty effective.
Chairman, when serving as Commandant of the Marine Corps, you were the only service chief to oppose the integration of women into ground combat arms jobs and units and chose not to appear at the Secretary of Defense's press conference to announce the change. Now that you're chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, what's your current position on the issue? Are you now in favor of opening all military jobs and units to qualified women? If not, why not?
Yeah, I hope people will appreciate that when you provide military advice, you do so in good faith. And at the end of the day, when you're in uniform and you're inside the Department of Defense, you provide military advice, and then our civilian leadership, as it should be, makes a decision. So the day Secretary Carter made a decision, I had but one task, which was to, with full commitment implement the decision that Secretary Carter made and to make sure that the command climate that was set from our most senior leaders all the way down to the squad leaders was an effective command climate to implement that decision. I also want to tell you that when I made the recommendation to Secretary Carter, it wasn't a I don't recommend women be integrated. First of all, even as a commandant in the Marine Corps, I opened up all but 2% of the occupational fields in the Marine Corps as my recommendation. And with those fields that I did not recommend, I outlined the specific conditions that I thought should be set before we move forward with full integration. So it was a question of, Mr. Secretary, we've done some very careful analytic work. We've done some experimentation. Here's the issues that should be considered when we go to full integration. And my recommendation is we address these issues before we integrate. In a conversation, he said, okay, that's fine. I understand your perspective. I believe that we can address the issues. He said, I accept the issues that you've raised. And by the way, if you look at the memo that Secretary Carter signed out to implement the decision, every single issue that is in the letter that I sent to him is reflected in Secretary Carter's implementation memo. And he said, okay, General, I got it, but here's what I believe. I believe the issues that you've raised can be addressed in implementation, and this process doesn't have to be sequential. I said, I got it, yes, sir, and we've been off. And so I haven't thought about anything other than executing the Secretary's decision since that day, and that's the way it ought to be.
Along those lines, Mr. Chairman, there are thousands of transgender service members who are honorably serving in the military today. Last year, then-Secretary Carter created the new policy allowing transgender individuals to openly serve and allow new transgender recruits to join. Why is the Pentagon considering changing this policy?
Okay, first of all, let's be clear. The transgender personnel are serving right now, and there's no review ongoing that would affect the ability of those currently serving to continue serving, provided they can meet the physical and mental qualifications of service, be worldwide deployable, and the same standards that every other soldier, sailor, airman, and marine meets. The issue now is the challenges of assessing individuals and the criteria for assessing. And so there have been some issues raised with regard to challenges of assessing transgender individuals, and that's what the Secretary is reviewing. So this is not a reversal of the policy that was implemented before. This is the next phase of implementation was accessions, and there have been some issues identified with accessions that, you know, some of the service chiefs believe need to be resolved before we move forward. And so that's where we are right now.
The Joint Strike Fighter is entering service, but with many cost overruns and delays. Will it continue as a program, or is it too expensive to maintain?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question, and someone has an agenda in the way that they phrase that question. But first of all, the F-35 is operationally deployed today, so it will remain as a program. The initial operating capability in the Marine Corps was made before I changed jobs in July of 2015. I had sufficient confidence in the F-35 to declare it initially operational capable and declare that first squadron capable of worldwide deployment, and it subsequently has deployed. We also, you will see in the budget, have a significant buy of F-35s in the budget this year, and would expect that to continue in the future. The challenges associated with the F-35, whether they be engineering or cost overruns, you know, I would argue, and not anomalous to many, many other programs that we have had inside the Department of Defense, and frankly, the cost overruns. A bit of that is history because over the past 18 to 24 months, I think most people would argue, and Congress certainly, I think, supports this perspective, that the program manager has done a great job of getting a lot of those cost overruns back in check, and the cost of the aircraft and the operation and sustainment cost also in check. So the short answer is the F-35 is a critical program. I believe it's not a better F-18 or a better bomb truck, fourth generation, but it's a transformational capability. Both its ability to deliver ordnance as well as its ability to serve literally as a server in the sky is going to transform the way we fight. And I think we fully haven't appreciated all the things it's going to do to change our warfighting concepts.
With the proliferation of, quote unquote, lone wolf actors of terror, what steps are being taken by the U.S. military to prevent Osama bin Laden's grown son from perpetuating terror strictly in the U.S.?
Okay, those seem to me to be two separate issues, right?
Yes.
Lone wolf in the United States and then Osama bin Laden's son. Earlier I spoke about this network for intelligence and information sharing. So to the latter question, making sure that we have a common intelligence picture, common operational picture, that is that we have a common understanding with all the nations that are affected by extremism is a critical part to keep those individuals from being able to plan and conduct external operations, which is job number one for us in the counterterrorism fight, is to prevent attacks on the United States or on our allies and partners. With regard to lone wolf attacks, we are in support of local and federal law enforcement officials. And so if you talk about lone wolf U.S. citizens inspired by propaganda, the military dimension of that problem is battlefield success that undermines the credibility of the narrative, even as local law enforcement and so forth deal with individual U.S. citizens who may be inspired to commit acts of violence.
We're running short on time, so I'm going to one more substance question, and then I'm going to give you our traditional mug. What can be done to stem the flow of refugees in the Mediterranean Sea and human suffering? Should refugee centers be built in North Africa and other areas to provide safe havens for those fleeing violence and famine? And what role should NGO or groups like the Vatican play?
Let me answer that question, at least in my lane. And I would argue, a lot of times when we look at violent extremism, we focus on the risk of attacks, and we should. The tragic loss of life associated with violent extremism is a big issue. But if you think about it, the most significant effect of violent extremism has been the flow of refugees. Certainly the impact it's had in Europe from a political perspective, and then just the sheer human suffering that's taken place as a result of 10 million people, just in the case of Syria, that have been dislocated or have become refugees. About half have become refugees, half have been dislocated inside of Syria. So it's a tragic outcome of violent extremism. I think the military dimension of that particular problem is working with local partners to create the conditions where people can be safe at home and don't have the need to go and become refugees. And obviously we can also support in providing some immediate support in the form of water supplies and food and making sure that the conditions are conducive to non-governmental organizations or, in the case of USAID or government organizations, to be able to provide that kind of support. But we work very closely with USAID, particularly in stabilization of places like Mosul and Raqqa. And I can tell you, when we sit down and develop a campaign plan for Raqqa and Mosul, sitting at the table is USAID to make sure that we can go into stabilization immediately after hostilities cease and set conditions as quickly as possible to relieve some of the human suffering.
Before I ask the last question, I'm going to present our traditional National Press Club mug. And, Mr. Chairman, your picture will go on the wall outside with the rest of the historic speakers that have been coming here since we started the speakers program in 1920. Last question goes back to Syria.
Wait a minute.
Last question. But I said one before.
All right.
Can you expand upon your plans after ISIL is defeated? That's an optimistic question. You say that the does it become a safe zone? Are you prepared to protect it from aerial attack? And is there a no-fly zone? And are you then planning to expand that zone?
Okay, I think it's probably, if you don't mind, I'm going to answer a different question. I mean, I'll answer the Raqqa piece, but there's a broader question, which is, what about after ISIS? So after ISIS and Raqqa, I mentioned earlier, we're working now with the State Department to make sure there's effective governance there, make sure there's local forces that are recruited to provide security inside of Raqqa, and that's our plan for Raqqa. But what I would tell you is that violent extremism is not over with ISIS. And that's why, in fact, one of the reasons why I'm running now at 1330 is we have 1:30, we have all of our combatant commanders and service chiefs together here in about 30 minutes for a quarterly review of where we are in dealing with violent extremism and very much looking towards long-term framework for our operations. Again, I talked earlier about politically, fiscally, and militarily sustainable with an assumption that this is a long-term fight and making sure that we constantly review our organizational construct, making sure sure we constantly review our intelligence sharing relationships, making sure we constantly review the success of our partners on the ground and what additional support they need is all part of what we're trying to do. But this is a long-term fight, and so Raqqa is tactical. Mosul is tactical. I believe it'll have strategic effects on the overall messaging because it certainly undermines the credibility that there's a physical caliphate that exists in the Middle East when they lose Raqqa and Mosul. But we ought not to confuse success in Raqqa and Mosul as something that means it's the end of the fight. I think we should all be braced for a long fight, and that's why we so emphasize making sure that we have the broadest network possible of partners to help deal with this challenge, because it's not about just the United States. It's about the 120-plus countries from which foreign fighters have come just to Iraq and Syria. And to the degree that we can get all 120 of those countries or as many of them as possible to cooperate in intelligence sharing, information sharing, and effective action, limit the freedom of movement of foreign fighters, limit their ability to share resources and erode the effectiveness of their narrative, that will be successful. But again, we're prepared for a long-term fight and a constant review of how we're addressing it. If there's one thing I would leave you with, don't ever think that that those of us in uniform are complacent about any of the issues that we've spoken about today. In fact, I tell people that, you know, when I was a second lieutenant, my level of experience arguably was way down here, but my level of confidence that I had all the answers was way up here. And as I speak to you today, my level of experience is arguably way up here, and my level of confidence on the issues that we're dealing with that I have all the answers is way down here. These are extraordinarily complex, if not wicked, problems we're dealing with. And beware of those with too much confidence that they have all the answers. Thank you.
Thank you. I ask as you keep your stay in your seats as the chairman leaves the hall.
That was yesterday at the National Press Club, and for those of you who stuck around and listened to this, I commend you. And like I said, one of the reasons I do enjoy this program is the chance to bring stuff like that normally people don't listen to yet. You've seen a couple of headlines come out of there. One is about the F-35. Another one is about... what was the strategy? Oh, no, the line of communication is still open with the Russians. But yeah, that's what you've seen as headlines around the nation relative to that discussion. His talking about the strategy post-ISIS in Syria, his talking about the formulation of a strategy for East Asia as part of the DOD and SECDEF's plan for Afghanistan going forward, which will take place. The strategy for Afghanistan takes place within the confines of within the construct of an East Asian strategy. So what is that? How does it make sense? How does it fit into what the DOD does? How does it fit into American strategic policy? So that is what you get from that, you know. And he is honestly an amazing, amazingly bright. One thing that I didn't realize. Because you get a sense, how about at the end when he uses the word wicked? That's the whole Boston thing. You can't get away from it. But one of the things, so I meet him, and I work for him. And when I say I work for him, I mean, if you're sitting in your desk right now, extend your hand as far away from your shoulder as you can. Okay, double that. That's how far I work from Joe Dunford. Okay, he's working for Jim Mattis. He's Mattis's chief of staff. John Kelly is Mattis's deputy commander. Dunford works for both of them. I work for Dunford and support Kelly and Mattis. That's how this whole thing works. So what you very, very quickly learn is you learn Dunford is very, very affable and bright and extremely respectful, attention to detail, you know, and works hard, works long. What I didn't realize until I had worked for him for a few months was that he's the smartest guy in the room. And I mean, you can imagine. Kelly Mattis and Dunford, I mean, they're three gigantic intellects. All three of them are. Readers, inquisitive, experienced like crazy, unbelievable. But it wasn't until, I think it was after General Kelly left, and Colonel Dunford was promoted to Brigadier General and became the Assistant Division Commander. And then really General Mattis left that summer and General Natonski showed up. And then it was General Dunford under General Natonski, and his work in planning sessions and things, he was incredible. And it's like, wow, he's the smartest dude in the room by not a little bit either. And there's a whole lot of smart dudes in here. And so you get a chance to see that a little bit here. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll wrap things up on a Tuesday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.